much the invitation to be working with you this week in the gospel meeting. I've been in the area a couple of times. I guess back in 2008 was the first occasion I had to be in the Pensacola area when Matt's father was preaching over at East Hill, held a meeting over there, and I think that I met at least a few of you during that particular gospel meeting, came back in 2010, and really have enjoyed both of those occasions to get to be with brethren in this area, but have really been looking forward to being here, and have just such a wonderful, deep, close friendship with Matt and Aaron, and being able to stay with them is going to be a real treat for me. Someone asked me as I walked in, where are you from? And I never know quite how to answer that question because I live in Kansas City, Missouri, but I'm not from Kansas City, Missouri. I've been there for 4 years. I was raised in Oklahoma, central Oklahoma, around Oklahoma City. Lived, I guess, about half my life in Oklahoma, about half my life in Texas. So I don't know which one to say I'm from, but I'll claim them both. But it's always a good opportunity and a blessing to be able to be down here in Florida, or as I think some people say, Lower Alabama, something like that. It's always good to be in this particular area, and I'm looking forward to getting to know all of you better and working with you this week. The lesson this morning is going to be from 1 Corinthians chapter 10, and if you will be opening your Bibles there to 1 Corinthians chapter 10, I'd like for you to notice with me a text. If you're like me, you've probably read over this particular passage a number of times, and you know essentially what the immediate meaning of the particular passage is, but how does it fit in the context? You know, this is something that troubled me for many years as a Christian, is I knew I was familiar with a number of different passages in the Bible, but being able to connect the dots and to understand how they connected, what was the context, why is the Bible saying that in this particular passage, and how does it work with everything else that's within it? You know, a text without a context is merely a pretext. If we're not using it according to its context, then we're probably going to be using it wrong. So it's always important that we understand how a particular passage fits within its context. What is the overall purpose of why this was written to the saints that this particular letter was written to? And in 1 Corinthians 10, and in verse 1, Paul writes, "Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. All ate the same spiritual food, all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ." You notice there in verse 2 that he speaks about the fact that their fathers were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. You've probably turned to this passage and maybe studied it or shared it with someone and talking about the subject of baptism. But you know, Paul isn't talking about baptism in this particular section of 1 Corinthians. He talks about it in Romans chapter 6. He talks about it in Colossians chapter 2. He brings it up, at least in passing, in 1 Corinthians chapter 12. But he's not talking about baptism in this context. And furthermore, why is he talking about the Israelites, their fathers, being baptized into Moses? What is the purpose of this? Have you ever wondered, why is that there? I mean, I understand why the passage in Acts chapter 2 and verse 38 is there. You've got the context leading up to that as Peter's preaching the first gospel sermon. They're convicted that Jesus is the Son of God. They ask, what shall we do? And Peter tells them what to do in order to be saved. Why is this text here? Maybe you don't ask questions like that, but I do. And as I've gone through this, it's one of those things that, well, I don't have time to dig into that right now. I think I know what that means, and we read over it, and we go on to something else. But I'd like to dig into this morning, if you'll do that with me, and try to understand this particular passage. When we look at a passage like this, as I said, what we're trying to do is understand the context. And the context is, when you're looking at a text, at a passage, there is the immediate context, the passages that are immediately around it, just before it and just after it. There is the remote context, those that are more distant. Let's maybe take in the entire letter or book or chapters before and after. As we're looking at this particular context, I would suggest to you that the context could be titled, "Don't Let Your Liberty Become Your Lord." Now, I know that doesn't sound like it has anything to do with the Israelites being baptized into Moses, but just maybe jot this down in your notes. The context is actually chapters 8, 9, and 10. We can't fully understand chapter 10, or really any section of chapter 10, if we haven't read chapters 8 and 9 to take in that entire context. Think about 1 Corinthians with me, if you will. In the first couple of chapters, really in the first three chapters or so, Paul's dealing with the problem of carnality and division among the Corinthians there in that church. And the fact that there was a sense in which they weren't even spiritually minded enough for him to teach some of the things he wanted to be able to teach to them. They were babes to a large degree. As he gets to chapter 5, he deals with the problem of sexual immorality that was within that congregation and not being dealt with as it should have been dealt with. In chapter 6, problems with brethren bringing one another to courts of law when they should have been dealing with this among themselves. Chapter 7, questions about marriage. Chapters 8, 9, and 10 are a context within themselves. And they have to do with things sacrificed to idols and the proper understanding of those things. I would, though, suggest that the overall theme of chapters 8, 9, and 10 is do not let your liberty become your Lord. A liberty is something that God allows, but that is not necessary. Baptism's authorized, but it's not a liberty. It's commanded. It's something we must do. But there are other things that as Christians we have the right to do, but we don't have to do. We were talking on the way up here about certain expediencies like that, like having a church building to meet in. We're certainly at liberty to have a place to meet. You can't assemble without a place. And that place is determined by what is most expedient. It is a liberty. It's something that's allowed or authorized, but not required. There are a lot of liberties in our life as Christians, things that God allows, but that we don't have to do. And what we've got to make sure that we don't do is to allow something that we don't have to do rule us or be something so big in our life that I'm going to do that, I don't care what. It's kind of what Paul was dealing with in this context. I want us to look, though, first at the remote context of this particular passage. When we look at the remote context, chapters 8, 9, and 10, it is concerning things offered to idols. Look in chapter 8 and in verse 1. Paul writes, "Now concerning things offered to idols, we know that we all have knowledge. Knowledge puffs up, but love edifies." Notice he begins the chapter concerning things offered to idols. Look back in chapter 7. Just flip back a page or look back a page if you will. Chapter 7 and verse 1. He makes a transition. "Now concerning things of which you wrote to me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman." And he deals with questions about marriage. See how he starts that particular chapter out? And so he is dealing with each one of these things. Look in chapter 12. You'll have chapter 12, 13, and 14 in a section or context. "Now concerning spiritual gifts." And you'll remember that he deals with spiritual gifts or questions about spiritual gifts in chapters 12, 13, and 14. But when he starts a new section like this, he starts it many times by saying, "Now concerning, pertaining to the things of which you wrote to me," or the questions that you had. Well, in chapter 8, 9, and 10, it is pertaining to things offered to idols. Look as he finishes the context in chapter 10 and in verse 33. "Just as I also please all men in all things, seeking not my own profit, but the profit of many, that they all may be saved." Verse 31 is what I was looking for. "Therefore, whether you eat or drink, whatever you do, do all to the glory of God." So, he's talking about things offered to idols, that they might eat or that they might drink. And what his point is here is that eating meats offered to idols was sometimes expedient. It was lawful, but sometimes it was not expedient. Let me clarify what I just said, because I said it wrong. Paul is explaining to them that eating meats that had been offered to idols was lawful, it was not sinful, but sometimes it was not expedient. Let's go back to chapter 8 and start noticing this. In verse 4, he says, "Therefore, concerning the eating of things offered to idols, we know that an idol is nothing in the world and that there is no other God but one." So he's saying that idol is make-believe. It's not real. It's not really a God. It does not change this meat in any particular way. Look down in verse 8. "But food does not commend us to God, for neither if we eat are we the better, nor if we do not eat are we the worse." He's saying it's a matter of indifference to God. It's not right or wrong, either one. Look in chapter 10 and in verse 23. He says, "All things are lawful for me." Of course, that is within the context of what he's dealing with, meat offered to idols. "All things are lawful for me, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful for me, but not all things edify." So he is telling us that within that realm of what is lawful, not all of those things are actually going to be helpful or expedient for us. Now, we learn from that particular text that in order for a thing to be expedient, it has to first be authorized. We'll be talking about that more tomorrow night in our lesson. But many times, brethren that are bent on doing things that there's no authority for will try to authorize it by saying it's an expedient. You don't authorize a thing by saying it's an expedient. You first see if it's authorized, and then you find within what is authorized an expedient way of carrying out that authorized work. That's the idea of an expedient. And not all things within what is authorized, not all of those things actually do expedite. Sometimes they could be cumbersome, or they could be a burden on the church, or they could be something that would not be helpful. That's what Paul's pointing out here in this particular passage. So eating meat is lawful, but it is not always expedient. So what Paul does here, beginning in chapter 8, is he makes an appeal to these Corinthians that they would be willing to forego or do without any liberty that might cause a brother to stumble or hinder the salvation of another person. Go back to verse 1 of chapter 8. "Concerning things offered to idols, we know that we all have knowledge. Knowledge puffs up, but love edifies." Look at verse 7. "However, there is not in everyone that knowledge." What knowledge? Well, the knowledge that an idol is nothing. The knowledge that it is lawful to eat this meat. Not everyone has that knowledge, he says in verse 7. "For some," I'm still in verse 7, "there is not in everyone that knowledge. For some, with consciousness of the idol until now, eat it as a thing offered to an idol, and their conscience being weak is defiled." Drop down to verse 9. "But beware lest somehow this liberty of yours become a stumbling block to those who are weak." What liberty is he talking about? Eating meat sacrificed to idols. It's not wrong. You are at liberty to do that. You are allowed. You're authorized to do that. But don't let that liberty become a stumbling block, something that would cause someone else to sin, to those who are weak. "For if anyone," verse 10, "sees you who have knowledge eating in the idol's temple, will not the conscience of him who is weak be emboldened to eat those things offered to idols? And because of your knowledge shall the weak brother perish for whom Christ died. But when you thus sin against the brethren and wound their weak conscience, you sin against Christ. Therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never again eat meat lest I make my brother stumble." So he is making that appeal. This is a liberty. It's authorized, but don't do anything that's going to cause a brother to sin against his own conscience or to stumble in that particular way. So this is chapter 8. He's making that appeal. Now, what is chapter 9? How does it fit within the context? Well, in chapter 9, Paul begins to explain that he himself was willing to forego the liberty or the right to do a lot of things in order to save the lost. For instance, notice he says in verse 1 of chapter 9, "Am I not an apostle? Am I not free? Have I not seen Jesus Christ our Lord? Are you not my work in the Lord? If I am not an apostle to others, yet doubtless I am to you." He's saying, you know I'm an apostle of Jesus Christ. Look at verse 4. "Do we have no right to eat and drink? Do we have no right to take along a believing wife as do the other, do also the other apostles, the brothers of the Lord and Cephas? Or is it only Barnabas and I who have no right to refrain from working?" He brings up three things here. Do I have no right to eat and drink? Is that, he's saying, is that why I don't eat these things? There were certain things Paul was refraining from eating or drinking. And I expect that based on the context, it was things that had been offered to idols. He's saying, do you think I don't do that because I don't have the right to do it? Well, that's a rhetorical question. The answer is no, that's not why he does it. He says, do I not have a right to take along a believing wife? Do you think that's why I'm not married, because I'm not authorized to be married? The answer is no, that's not why. He says, do you think that I don't have a right to demand and receive financial support from you as a church? Do you think that I have to work to support myself? The answer is no. Okay, then why? Why did Paul not take along a believing wife? Why did Paul not demand their support? He's still making this argument in verse 7. He's saying, whoever goes to war at his own expense, who plants a vineyard and does not eat of its fruit, who tends a flock and does not drink of the milk of the flock. He says in verse 9, it is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain. Is it oxen God is concerned about? Or does it say it altogether for our sakes? For our sakes, no doubt, this is written, that he who plows should plow in hope, he who threshes in hope should be a partaker of this hope. If we've sown spiritual things, for you is it a great thing if we reap your material things? Then he says in verse 13, do you not know that those who minister the holy things eat of the things of the temple? Verse 14, even so, the Lord has commanded that those who preach the gospel should live from the gospel. So what's his point? His point is, I have a right to receive support from you. But he wasn't doing it. Why not? Verse 15, but I've used none of these things, nor have I written these things, that it should be done so to me, for it would be better for me to die than that anyone should make my boasting void. He is explaining, or in verse 16, let's go ahead and read on through 18. For if I preach the gospel, I have nothing to boast of, for necessity is laid upon me. Yes, woe is me if I do not preach the gospel. For if I do this willingly, I have a reward, but if against my will, I have been entrusted with a stewardship. What is my reward then? That when I preach the gospel, I may present the gospel of Christ without charge, that I may not abuse my authority in the gospel. Paul is explaining here that out of all of these things, he had a right to eat these things and drink these things. He didn't do it because he didn't want to hinder somebody's salvation. He had a right to take along a wife, but that would have hindered his ability to preach in a lot of places in these Gentile countries that he was otherwise able to go. And saving the lost was more important to him than his liberty or his right to be married. Receiving support from the church at Corinth, he had a right to do that. But he was afraid that some of them might think that he was preaching only for the money. He didn't want to do anything that was going to hinder them hearing the gospel. So he chose to refrain from taking that support. It wasn't a matter of what was right or wrong. In all of these areas, Paul's saying, I have the right to do it, but because I love the souls of other men and women, and I see or believe I see that this would be a hindrance, this liberty would be a hindrance, I'm going to refrain from it. Again, why is he saying this? Because back in chapter 8, he was making an appeal to them to refrain from eating certain meats if it might cause a brother to stumble. Now, their attitude might have been, well, you can't tell me not to eat that meat. There's nothing wrong with it. Well, that's right. There's nothing inherently wrong with it. But if eating it's going to cause someone to be lost, now there is something wrong with that. We have to have the attitude that we're willing to forego these things that might cause someone else to stumble. And Paul was always willing to submit his liberties to those who are unknowing in a sacrificial effort to win their salvation. Let's look back at verse 19 of chapter 9. He says, "For though I am free from all men, I've made myself a servant to all, that I might win the more, and to the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might win the Jews." What does that mean? That means that Paul was willing to be more restrictive on himself than he had to be. For instance, maybe not working on the Sabbath day. He didn't want to do something that would cause a Jew to stumble, not that that was bound upon him anymore under the law of Christ, or to observe the Passover, or other feast days. Remember in about Acts 22 or so, when Paul comes into Jerusalem, the elders tell him that it would be in their, they believe it'd be in his best judgment to go down to the temple and to take this vow with these other men and to offer some things to show the Jews that he's not anti-Jew now. There had been some rumors swirling around that Paul was completely opposing Moses and the law, and that wasn't true. Paul wasn't trying to destroy the law. He was trying to introduce the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so he did these things to show the Jews he was not an enemy of their cultural traditions. So in that sense, Paul said, "To the Jews I became as a Jew." He goes on to say here in verse 19, or in verse 20, rather, "To those who are under the law, as under the law, that I might win those who are under the law. To those who are without law," that would be the Gentiles, "as without law." Then he explains, not being without law toward God, but under law toward Christ, "that I might win those who are without the law." Paul was not saying here that he did things that he wasn't authorized to do. He's talking about those without the law of Moses, the Gentiles. They had their own peculiar scruples. One case at hand would be the meat offered to idols in the Gentile culture. For them, that was fellowship with the idol. They couldn't eat that meat. Well, there wasn't anything wrong with eating the meat per se. But if they couldn't eat it without a perception that they were in fellowship with that idol, then they didn't need to eat it. And for maybe a Jew to come along and say, "Well, that's just ridiculous. I'm going to eat it anyway. I'm going to have these people over for dinner, and that's what we're going to serve for dinner." Paul's saying, don't do that. Don't cause them to do something that they would feel like they're sinning doing. And so in this particular case, he's saying that he was more restrictive with himself in regards to the law in order that he wouldn't cause a Jew to stumble in their obedience to Christ. When he's preaching to Gentiles, he would be more restrictive on himself than he had to be so as not to do those things that would cause them to stumble. And this is the point of becoming as one without law. He says in verse 22, "To the weak I became as weak." That doesn't mean weak in spirituality. He's talking about those who have a weak conscience. When a Gentile was taught the gospel, clearly the Gentiles at Corinth were taught in chapter 8 that those idols are nothing. They were taught the truth. Meat does not commend me to God. I'm neither the better if I eat or do not eat. Paul was teaching those Gentiles there's nothing wrong with eating. But sometimes when we come out of a false religion, we learn something intellectually, but it takes a while to catch up emotionally. There are some things that we see are not wrong, but we've been taught that they're wrong for so long that we can't do it without feeling wrong doing it. Even though intellectually, 2 + 2 = 4, we understand it's not wrong, but it just feels wrong. And so what Paul is explaining here is that for some of these people that have that Their intellect knows that it's all right to do, but their conscience is still weak. It has not been strengthened to the point to understand, I can do this with clear conscience. Paul says to those people, I became like them. I would refrain from doing the things they would refrain from doing because I don't want to push them into doing something that would cause them to sin against their conscience. And then it's in verse 22, he says, I have become all things to all men that I might by all means save some. Again, liberal brethren will take this passage out of context and try to explain it to mean that we just need to dress like the world and act like the world and be cool in the world's eyes so that we can save them. That's not what Paul was saying. That is an application of this verse that says, I'm going to be more liberal or I'm going to be more loose in my application of God's will than I'm allowed to be. That's not what Paul was saying. Paul was saying, I'm going to be more restrictive with myself than I have to be. Never in the New Testament, not in Romans 14, not in 1 Corinthians 8, not in 1 Corinthians 9, does the Scripture ever teach us that it's ever all right to be more loose than what the Scriptures allow or authorize. And this verse is not one of them either. But there are times that we might need to be more restrictive with ourselves than what God even restricts. That is out of love for our brethren to keep someone from stumbling. And that's his point. He says, that I might by all means save some. Verse 23, listen, now this I do, not taking along a believing wife, not demanding their support, not eating and drinking certain things. Now this I do for the gospel's sake, that I might may be a partaker of it with you. Because I just want you to be saved. And if you can appreciate why I was willing to forego these things, then you ought to be willing to forego those things. I'll tell you what, I can appreciate what Paul is arguing here. For him to say that this is the reason he wasn't married, we see he even deals with that to some degree in chapter 7 when he talks about the present distress and the fact that it was going to be easier for him to preach if he did not take along a wife. I'll tell you what, I'm not sure. If that's what it came down to preach the gospel, that would be a tough call for me. Married, have 3 children. I think about doing without that blessing that God's given me, that liberty that I have. You don't have to be married. You don't have to have a family to be right with God. Paul did it. But it is certainly authorized and it is right and is pure and it's good. But there are some times, Paul's showing us, when it is in the best interest of the kingdom or the gospel for us to forego some of those liberties. And in this context, it had to do with the liberties pertaining to the eating of meat sacrificed to idols. Go to chapter 10 at the end of the chapter as he closes and notice in verse 32 and 33. He says, give no offense either to the Jews or to the Greeks or to the church of God, just as I also please all men in all things, not seeking my own profit, but the profit of many, that they may be saved. This is what it's all about for Paul. So the immediate context then, the remote context is concerning things offered to idols. The immediate context is this, that those who are unwilling to forego some liberties will not be victors and finish this race. Look with me in verse 24. As he closes chapter 9, do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may obtain it. Well, what way is that? What way do we run to obtain eternal life in heaven? He said, everyone who competes for the prize, he's talking about in temporal affairs, in a temporal race. Everyone who competes for the prize is temperate or self-controlled in all things. Now they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we for an imperishable crown. Therefore I run thus, not with uncertainty. Thus I fight, not as one who beats the air, but I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified. Paul's saying, you know these athletes, he's going back to the Olympiad type games. He said, you know these athletes, if they really want to win, there's certain things that they don't get to do. You take somebody who's training for the Summer Olympics. they're training for years, and they eat a very strict diet. They have a rigorous workout plan. Those young people don't get to run around with their friends and go hang out on Friday nights. Many of them have to be pulled out of school and have a tutor teach them through those years that they're training. They certainly don't get to eat whatever they want. Well, why do they do that? It's not because it's against the rules to eat that food. It's not because it's against the rules to go hang out with your friends or stay up late at night. It's because you will not win unless you forego some of those liberties. Any athlete that's going to be successful is going to have to forego some things that are liberties. It's all right to do, but not necessary. Paul's saying, if we can understand that in the temporal realm, why can't we understand it in the spiritual realm? Just because God's authorized a thing doesn't mean that we have to do it. And he says, I discipline myself. I have to do this with my own self. Now, what was the problem? Go back to chapter 8 and verse 1. Now, concerning things offered to idols, we know that we all have knowledge. Knowledge puffs up, but love edifies. And if anyone thinks that he knows anything, he knows nothing yet as he ought to know. Verse 9. Beware lest somehow this liberty of yours become a stumbling block to those who are weak. And then, of course, verses 11 through 13. Because of your knowledge shall the weak brother perish. This overconfidence in knowledge. Well, I know this isn't wrong. Well, that's not all there is to Christianity. You notice he said in verse 1, knowledge puffs up, but love edifies. In order for me to be successful as a child of God, not only in reaching the lost, but even personally, I have to have a knowledge of God's will. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. You know, the problem we deal with to a large degree out here in the religious world is many of our friends, they just don't have a knowledge of God's will. They just don't study to show themselves approved. And when we ask them, what about this verse? What about this verse? You know what they'll often say? Well, you've got a head knowledge. I've got a heart knowledge. You ever heard that? Somebody say, I don't know about all these thou shalts and thou shalt nots, and I don't know about all these Bible verses. You know the Bible a lot better than me. I just know I love the Lord and so on. Well, I want to tell you, Hosea said, my people are destroyed for a lack of knowledge. And as a matter of fact, as we start here in chapter 10, where we found our text, Paul said, moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware, or I would not have you ignorant. You can't afford to not know the will of God. But, chapter 8, he says, knowledge puffs up. His point is that in order for us to be successful, our knowledge has to be coupled with the proper love for our brethren. If we have knowledge without love, we'll do what these saints were doing. We'll say, I don't care. This isn't wrong. I know it's not wrong. I'm going to do it. And they can get over it. That's not the right attitude. On the other hand, you have the other extreme that a lot of our friends in denominationalism have, where they say, well, I love everybody. And they do. They're very loving, but they don't have a knowledge of God's will. You'll be lost doing that too. We have to have the balance of a knowledge of God's will and a love for the Lord and a love for our brethren. And so what they were doing is they didn't care how this affected their brethren. I want to eat this meat. Nobody's going to tell me that I can't have this steak. Nobody's going to tell me that I can't have, whatever, my happy hour root beer or cherry limeade at Sonic. I don't know if you have Sonic here, but some drive-in, you know. Some people get so caught up in their favorite thing to eat or their favorite thing to drink, nobody's going to tell me I can't do that. Well, I understand from the standpoint, nobody needs to say this is sinful in and of itself and to bind where God has it bound. But we have to have the right love for our brethren that we're willing to forego these things. And that's what Paul's talking about. You know, we make application of this verse over and over again where Paul says, I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I preach to others, I myself should become disqualified. Why was he saying that? It was in this context. Paul is saying, even I could be lost. He said, even with all of my knowledge as an apostle, I could be lost, verse 27. Problem is that their overconfidence and knowledge could actually be their spiritual undoing. It could cause them to be lost. So, With that in mind, when we get to our text, in chapter 10 and verses 1 through 13, he's now giving us an Old Testament example of some who had been saved, but then they were lost. They didn't finish that race. You know why? Because they didn't exercise self-discipline. They weren't willing to forego some things in order to get where they needed to get to. Think about it. The children of Israel, how many times did they murmur and complain against God because of what they didn't have in the wilderness? And all of these things were liberties. They talked about the food that they had back in Egypt. Well, they didn't have to have that food. God provided them what they needed. The manna, he provided water when it was needed. God always provided what they needed. Now, it wasn't what they wanted all the time, but he provided what they needed. But God's promise was, it's okay, because when you get to the promised land, you're going to have everything. They didn't want to wait. They wanted it right now. And Paul is using them as an example. Let's start here in chapter 10. Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, all ate the same spiritual food and drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with most of them, God was not well pleased. How many? All of them, with the exception of Joshua and Caleb. They were the only two adults that entered the promised land. With most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. That includes Moses. That includes Aaron. That includes Moses' sister, Miriam. They died. They did not enter in. I'm not saying they committed the same sin that the other people committed, but they didn't enter in. Only Joshua and Caleb. Verse 6, listen. Now these things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. And do not become idolaters as were some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Look at what they were focused on. Eating and drinking. Nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did. And in one day 23,000 fell. Nor let us tempt Christ as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents. Remember their grumbling when they were bitten by serpents and Moses put the serpent up on the brass pole. Nor complain, as some of them also complained and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now all things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Now therefore let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. No temptation has overtaken you, except such as is common to man, but God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted above what you are able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it. All of this saying, look at what happened to them. They were not willing to forego certain things. They complained about it. They let it overcome them. And they were lost. Don't be like them. What's the point of the passage about baptism? Here it is. The point is that they were baptized and delivered from bondage, just like we are in baptism. The point is that they ate of or were partakers of spiritual food, just like we are of the Lord's Supper. And yet their bodies were scattered along that racetrack without reaching the end. I want to tell you, brethren, I don't know that there's a better passage or context in the Bible that teaches the fallacy of once saved, always saved than this one right here. If Paul was not saying that they were saved or delivered by their baptism into Moses, then I don't know what he's saying at all. This text makes no sense at all. It only makes sense if Paul is showing them here are people who were saved, and then look at what they let happen. They let their liberties become their Lord, and that caused their demise. Things that were not wrong in and of themselves, but they were consumed with them, and their bodies were scattered along the racetrack. What this shows us is that baptism is, in fact, necessary for salvation. And just quickly, these are some points that you could make from this text. Their baptism was in water, in the cloud, in the sea. Their baptism was a burial we see that they were in the sea. They were entombed in water with the cloud over them and the sea on both sides. Their baptism was by faith. They trusted in God and in Moses as they went through that water, and their baptism was unto salvation. We see that the Egyptians, their captors, like Satan and our sins being our captors, they were washed away in that same water. But their baptism was not a guarantee of salvation, was it? It certainly wasn't. Well, I've gone just a few minutes past the time. I appreciate your kind attention and hope that this study was helpful for you this morning. Thank you.